Welcome to Jill on the Hill, the podcast where we take a holistic look at the issues facing collegiate athletics today. I am St. Joseph's University Athletics Director Jill Bodensteiner, and joining me is my co-host from St. Joseph's Class of 2004, Jeff Martin. Jeff, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Jill. I'm really excited to join the show.
I am excited to have you on the show, Jeff. I think we have a great rapport, and I respect your knowledge of the issues, so we're going to have some fun with this. For our listeners, we've been on a hiatus for a while, and in that time, we've reimagined our approach to podcasting. We launched the St. Joseph's University Athletics radio show in the fall, featured at McGillicuddy's, and that gives listeners a direct connection to our players and coaches. So as a result of that, we're going to relaunch the podcast and spend each episode focusing on a specific aspect of college athletics. When we can, we hope to bring in Hawk alumni or experts to add context to the topic at hand.
So, Jill, for this first episode of the podcast, since we're focusing on single issues and taking deep dives, I wanted to ask you a little bit about how student athletes are making their voices heard on campus. I know that one of the first big initiatives you took on when you joined us was the creation of an athletic steering committee, and that includes a dozen or so student athletes. But before we get too deep into that committee itself, let's zoom back and talk about the topic in general. How has the importance of the student-athlete's voice evolved over the last handful of years?
Great question, Jeff, and it's really been almost a five-year journey, and I think the turning point that we have to look at is what many of our listeners is probably remember as the Northwestern Football Union case. And so a brief summary of what happened in the Northwestern case is that a group called the College Athletes Players Association, which is supported by the United Steelworkers, and which is really pushing the student-athlete voice concept, got with a group of Northwestern football student-athletes led by their quarterback at the time, King Coulter, I believe was his name. So the College Athletes Players Association and the Northwestern quarterback started evaluating, do student athletes have enough of a voice? And the answer in their mind was no. And therefore, the step that they took most immediately to change that was to try and form a union to represent the interests of the football student athletes at Northwestern. So as they pursued the union, Northwestern University challenged, saying that only employees can form a union under the law that governs unions, which is called the National Labor Relations Act. And we don't believe you're employees under the National Labor Relations Act. So what happens in a labor case like this is it first goes to a regional director of the what we call the National Labor Relations Board, or the NLRB. So the Chicago area regional director heard the case and said, I do believe that these Northwestern student-athletes are employees, and therefore they do have the right to unionize and collectively bargain with their employer, I'm using air quotes, on all aspects of the employment relationship. So that was a game changer in college athletics to consider the fact that student-athletes may be considered employees, subject and able to form a union. What happened the next year in 2015 was Northwestern appealed that regional director's decision, and it went to the entire federal NLRB board that sits in Washington, D.C., and the full board essentially reversed the regional director and said, we're not going to allow them to unionize. Interestingly, the board didn't say it's because we don't think they're employees. The board said, we're not going to let them unionize because, and this is really interesting to me, the nature of competitive sports is that it takes two to tango, right? It takes two teams to compete. And because only private institutions are subject to the National Labor Relations Act, you would have 17 football-playing schools who could unionize and 103 who could not. And they found that that discrepancy was against the public interest. And so they weren't going to, they, as we like to say, punted, pun intended, on the decision and said, again, we're not deciding they're not employees. We just don't think it would be in the public interest to let them pursue the union. So, you know, That was a very, very pivotal issue in the history of the student-athlete voice in college athletics.
So if at the federal level something couldn't be instituted, you know, what did the NCAA then do to sort of on a national level, on a macro level, address the issue?
I would say three things, some of which were in place long before 2015, but that have evolved. So three things. Number one, what we call SAC, the Student Athlete Advisory Council. Number two is, and I'm going to get into each of these in a little more detail, student athletes now actually have a vote on legislation. And number three, student athlete representation on NCAA governance committees. So first is what we call SAC. And SAC, each institution in the NCAA has a student athlete advisory council, a SAC, and we do here, of course, at St. Joe's. There's also then a conference SAC where you send one or more representatives and they meet with their conference colleagues. And then there's a national SAC. So the Atlantic 10 gets one representative. Right now it's a baseball player from LaSalle who serves as the A-10 representative on the national SAC. And the SAC has began in 1989, but its role has expanded exponentially. For example, on campus, the SAC was often seen as kind of a community service arm. And today they have direct input on legislative matters in, facing member institutions at the NCAA level. Secondly, as of 2015, the Power Five, if you will, which the formal name, Power Five Conferences, we formally call the Autonomy Conferences.
Sure.
And that means they have the autonomy to pass their own legislation in some particularly delineated areas. And so, As I mentioned, as of 2015, those autonomy votes now include actual votes by 15 student athletes. So there are 65 member institutions in the Power Five, each of which get one vote. And then each of those five conferences has appointed three student athletes, each of whom get a vote. And I know what you might be saying, Jeff, and our listeners, which is, how can they really make a difference if they only have 15 out of 80 votes? But you would imagine being in a big room in an auditorium and a piece of legislation is being debated and 15 student athletes get to the microphone and say, this is what we feel. It's very hard to vote against that.
It's pretty compelling.
It's very compelling, and it's great to have their voice there. So, and then finally, again, I'm on the Name, Image, and Likeness Committee right now at the NCAA. I've been part of that for the last 5 months. We have three student athletes joining us at every in-person and on-the-phone committee meeting so that their voice is heard. So increased representation on committees. So I would say those three things sort of at the macro level is what the NCAA has done to continue to increase the student athlete voice.
What have we been doing here on Hawk Hill to go beyond that, to meet that? You know, what have students here on Hawk Hill been doing to make their voices heard?
So informally, I try and meet and develop relationships with as many student athletes as I can. That's really, really important to me. I think the reason I got into college athletics after a satisfying career as a practicing lawyer was to have more of a difference developing people and having that relational aspect. Sometimes when you're a lawyer, you just get called in to give advice and off you go. So I've really enjoyed getting to know them. And so a lot of that just comes on the informal relational level. But going back to something you raised at the beginning of our discussion, one of the first changes that I implemented was the creation of a steering committee at St. Joseph's. And so the steering committee, I'll first tell you a little bit about the membership. At any given year, depending on the roles, it could be between 12 and 18 members. The director of athletics, me, our faculty athletics representative, which is an NCAA required role, and we're lucky to have a phenomenal faculty athletics representative in Dr. Steve Porth here at St. Joe's. He's really truly understands the student athlete and the academic experience here at St. Joe's and really serves as the liaison between athletics and the academy. We always have the president of SAC as a member who's always a student, and then the student athlete representative who serves on the university student senate so that we can get some synergies between what student senate's doing. And then another NCAA designated position, which is called the Senior Woman Administrator, or SWA, and that role is filled by Renee Shields. In addition to that, I have the ability in consultation with SAC to appoint 6 to 12 additional student athletes, and then two head coaches. And right now, Lynn Farquhar from field hockey and Mike Glavin, track and field and cross country, represent the coaches on that steering committee. So that's the membership. The charge of the group is really fourfold. Number one, to help define departmental strategic plans and priorities. Some examples of that. You know, I created an action plan in my first year. It was a 5-page, here's what I'd like to accomplish in the first 2 years. And we discussed that as a group and made sure that the student athletes and others on the group had input into that. We've spent a good deal of time talking about nutrition, mental health, community service, and those kind of issues among our steering committee. The second goal is to have them provide input on national legislative and governance matters. And the biggest example there is I feel like I've educated them on the name, image, and likeness issues, kept them abreast of what's happening, and gotten great input from them. Third is university and departmental policy. An example of a great discussion we had was on the athletic department drug testing policy. Are we testing for the right drugs? Are we doing it at the right intervals? Should we continue to test? What if the NCAA does away with marijuana testing in light of the changing state laws? And we had a great discussion with our student athletes about that. And then finally, number four is key department decisions. And an example of where their input was really, really helpful was on our evaluation of our apparel deal. You know, what's important to you all, both when you were recruits and when now that you're here? And of course, the number one thing that's important to our student athletes is...
how cool is all my stuff?
Close, the footwear and how that feels and how that... But the cool factor, I think, is a close second. We call that reputational.
Sure.
So good guess, Jeff.
So this is a lot more than just FYI, these, you know, meetings that you have with them. They're giving you valuable feedback that you're then putting into your decision-making process.
Absolutely. I mean, they helped shape the criteria for that decision. They helped give us direction on what to do with the drug testing policy. They really helped us define the need for mental health resources and what those would look like. So again, I don't want to be the kind of leader who sits behind a closed door and presumes that I know what 18 to 22-year-olds are interested in. So I think that they would feel, I think if you spoke to them, they would feel that their voices are heard. They are, and it's been, mostly it's fun. We get together at 7 a.m. a couple times a semester. We have breakfast, and we get to know each other, and we talk about the issues of the day.
Good for them for getting up at 7 a.m. Are there more subtle ways that we've seen student-athlete voice change policy in college athletics?
Yeah, and this to me is fascinating. Again, I think this could be broken down into the informal and the formal. So starting with the informal, we haven't had one recently, but some years ago, 3-4 years ago, there was a series of incidents in college athletics that sort of started with a tweet, right? So student athletes have this new voice via social media. It used to be that student athletes were pulled out after the game. Their media personnel brought them to the waiting media, and that doesn't happen anymore. Everyone has their own media voice. And so, you know, the tweets would be along the lines of, and I'll keep the schools out of this for our conversation today, you know, shake my head, coach made me play injured. Well, in one particular institution, that led ultimately to an investigation that led to the firing of the coach, the athletic director, and the chancellor of the university. So that informal voice via social media is good and healthy and really new in the last really 5 or so years. More formally, I would say we've seen the student-athlete voice in two primary areas, and one is a topic you and I will dig into in the near future, which is transfers. And so, you know, without getting ahead of ourselves, the old transfer rules put a lot of power with the university. If we deny you permission, then you can't get aid at the next school. You can't get athletics financial aid. Well, the student-athlete started saying, wait a minute, why can my coach quit and go to another institution, but I can't without penalty. And
this person who recruited me is gone, but I'm stuck here.
Exactly.
You won't let me go.
Exactly. So I think that disconnect and the student-athlete voice really led the NCAA and member institutions to rethink our transfer rules, which we have, and which has resulted in an exponential increase in transfers.
Thousands of students transferring every year.
Yeah, I believe so. There's a new transfer portal that we'll talk about in one of our upcoming sessions, but I believe at one point there were 1,000 Division I men's basketball student athletes alone in the transfer portal. And so again, you know, changing the rules, people panic, oh my gosh, this is going to be free agency. Well, we're working through that. But their voice was really influential in that. And then I think the entire, you know, again, this is something we'll get into in the future, but the entire concept of amateurism, what does it mean to be an amateur? And should student athletes be able to at least collect money for selling endorsements and their name, image, and likeness? You know, that was driven through a more formal mechanism, the student athlete voice, through litigation. And so by working with the College Athletes Players Association and various plaintiffs' attorneys representing the student athlete voice, we've seen, you know, just several lawsuits against the NCAA and its member institutions that are really changing the way we look at amateurism and name, image, and likeness. So those are certainly some of the formal and informal ways that the voice has really taken hold.
And the last question I sort of want to ask about this is, how do you see the future of this partnership between student athletes and schools evolving, either here on Hawk Hill or in the broad scope of things? You know, how can we continue to give student athletes an active role in shaping their experience?
I think that, again, that's a multi-layered answer. And one of the things for institutions, not everyone has a steering committee like we do. But I think most institutions are re-examining the way they use their SAC committee. And I think that's, like I mentioned earlier, that's become a lot more heavy content and really giving the student athletes a serious voice in the content. But two other things I'll mention, and one, this goes back to media, communications, social media. When you think about the old sports media model and then look at what Players Tribune accomplished, which was really athletes telling their own story in their own voice, you're seeing a little more of that in college athletics now. I've already mentioned the informal use of social media. There's a company called Influencer that helps college athletics departments help their student athletes increase their brand and really post university content on their own social media and tell it kind of in their own way. So I do think the student-athlete voice through a variety of forms of media is going to continue to grow and change significantly in coming years. And then, you know, secondly, I think this name, image, and likeness and the amateurism lawsuits have led to a great opportunity for college athletics, those of us in it, to step back and say, what does the model look like in 2025? And, you know, not just name, image, and likeness, but the whole scope of things as our world of media and higher education and admissions, all of that has changed. And where are we now? Let's sort of take a pause and see where college athletics is now and where we should be. And that can really only happen with the student athlete voice in a variety of contexts I've talked about, from voting to representation on committees to the power of SAC, to institutional committees and to the informal media. So I think, you know, this isn't scary to me in general. This is what it should be. The student athletes, it's their experience. We're not always going to agree. And in some cases, student athletes start from a position where they might not have all the information. But I think after, you know, dialogue and conversation, I think it's been absolutely fabulous in every context in which I've been able to work directly with student athletes to shape, whether departmentally or at the NCAA level. I absolutely love it.
Not to mention how this is preparing them for the world after graduation. I mean, if part of the goal of college athletics is to prepare students for the world after college, having active roles in shaping their own lives from the beginning is certainly never a bad idea.
Thanks for raising that, because that's, you know, one might call it the side benefit of the steering committee and of SAC is learning, is the student athletes learning how to use their voice in really, really constructive ways. I saw an article recently in the NCAA's Champion magazine that sort of detailed the history of national SAC leaders, and several of them decided to go into college athletics administration. So for many people, it's impacting their career choice. Someone might say, boy, I'd never thought about it, but I want to be an athletic director, which is one of the reasons why having a diverse steering committee and a diverse SAC are really important. We need to have a diverse group of voices on both of those groups that are really not only impacting now, but thinking, hey, maybe I'd like to do what you do someday, Jill, which has been fun. And I certainly have had a couple people say that, which is exciting. So yes, the development of the student athletes on when they do get to use their voice is phenomenal.
Well, I look forward to seeing how these student athletes continue to shape this wonderful alma mater of mine. Thank you for this wonderful conversation, Jill.
Thank you, Jeff. Always a pleasure. And to our listeners, appreciate you coming back for our first episode of the rebooted Jill on the Hill. Our plan is to release a new episode each month during the academic year, and we ask you to stay tuned for our next episode in February. In the meantime, go Hawks.
Go Hawks.
Hawk will never die.